Welcome to a new episode of BFRR, our Bitcoin, Fiat and Rock and Roll podcast that explores the intersection of traditional finance, digital assets and digital money, and helps you understand how digital assets and money will evolve in the future. I'm co-host Jonas, and today I'm joined once again by an exciting guest. I'm delighted to welcome Joachim Schwerin to our podcast. Joachim is a principal economist at the European Commission, is, I think, a very vocal voice in various media outlets or events when it comes to digital money-related topics. So I guess most of our audience already know Joachim. Joachim contributed to the European Digital Finance Strategy, including the MiCA regulation, so also getting the hands very dirty when it comes to digital money-related topics. And Joachim holds a PhD from Dresden University of Technology and was postdoc research fellow at the London School of Economics, Economic History Department before joining the Commission already in 2001. So I'm, as I said, sure that most of the listeners already know Joachim. I mean, Joachim, you're super well-known in the space. So it's a great pleasure to have you in the podcast. Thanks for accepting my invite.
Jonas, the honor is entirely mine. And thank you very much for the kind introduction. I'm really grateful to have the opportunity to chat with you a little bit about a number of things. And as you rightly say, I'm principal economist at the European Commission, DG GROW. I speak today, as always, publicly in my own capacity, so nothing that I say prejudges the European Commission, but I'm just reflecting a little bit what is going on in my personal little head.
Perfect, and that's what I really appreciate. And I mean, Joachim, we are now in touch for many years, I would say, and I always, you know, enjoyed the discussions with you and always came out of that with a lot of energy, a lot of new ideas. So this was also the reason why I said, okay, finally, we need to make this podcast happen. And I really didn't know why it took us 343 episodes. But
neither do I, but I'm very happy to be here.
Nice. So what will we cover today? We will discuss, I mean, your work at the European Commission, so get a little bit of a feeling what you are doing, how this relates to Bitcoin, stablecoin, CBDCs, also understand a little bit more on what you think about these innovations. Of course, this could fill hours, days, months, but we keep this very short because we want to talk, I think, about a kind of major project, I at least think, that you initiated with a few other folks, which I think is super, super relevant and important. I'm also supporting this project or initiative, the so-called Digital Freedom Declaration, but maybe we park this for now and deep dive into this later. So to get a starting point, Joachim, as I said, you are principal economist at the European Commission. Like, how does, you know, your daily work look like, and which topics are kind of on your plate, if you will?
I've now been working at the European Commission for 24 years as an economist, and I started in 2001 in a unit that was responsible for industry policy. Actually, I did the interface between industrial policy and competition policy. So for the first 10 years, I was working on everything that was related to mergers, state aid, antitrust cases, but then from the industrial perspective. That was an interesting experience because it enabled me basically to get a detailed look into any sector and subsector of the economy that you can imagine, because we have thousands of these cases over time. I spent then 4 years of coordinating the two policies before I moved into access to finance for small and medium-sized enterprises, where I also stayed about 10 years. That was a long journey at that time where I worked my way through alternative finance, fintech, blockchain, crypto, tokenization, you name it. And then I focused on these latter aspects, first in a unit on digital transformation of industry, as we called it, as the representative of anything related to blockchain policy making, especially for the real economy, but also indeed working on finance together with my colleagues, MiCA regulation, digital euro, DLT pilot regime, everything that was going on. And last month, we had a new reorganization coming into force, which regularly happens in the Commission. So the new name of the unit I work is Responsible Business Conduct. And there I continue the work on blockchain crypto tokenization. But I have also, as the main theme within that now, governance of decentralized autonomous organizations, DAOs. So the question is, as we always take a very positive approach to these things, how can we leverage DAOs? How can we create a safer legal environment without jeopardizing the innovative nature of DAOs? So really not traditional regulatory approach, but to see in the long-term evolution of how can distributed systems or decentralization be supported from a public policy perspective without being too intrusive. And that is something that in a way explains what I do, because I'm here for the longer term vision. I try to understand technology. I try to understand developments on the various markets, and I advise policymakers and regulators on new initiatives when we draft regulation, when we do reports, things like that. Perhaps one remark, Jonas, that brings us to the core of what we're discussing here. I came into the field of all of this in my function still on competition law when I was working on state aid cases, because we had the financial crisis in 2007, 2008, where from basically one day to another, we suddenly had to save all these systemic banks, as they were called, because they were affected by the aftermath of Lehman Brothers and the financial crisis. And as we had 75% of European small and medium-sized companies financed to the banking sector, which is much more than in other parts of the world, these banks were very important to ensure the continuing flow of finance to enterprises. And that made us realize very strongly the risks that we face when we have over-reliance in centralized systems. And it is no coincidence, I say that as an economic historian, that we had within 6 weeks the bankruptcy of Lehman Brothers and the Bitcoin white paper. So basically the worst moment for the centralized systems and the nucleus for decentralization. And that is something that has really formed me very much, not only professionally, but also as a person, because I've always believed in self-organization and a bottom-up approach. And finally, we have the technology that gets us humans back on track, where we have always been as humans. We've never been people that believe too much in authority. We are people in Europe that have local and regional roots, that have very complex trading patterns along our preferences, that build communities along to our value systems, and that has always been constrained by the requirement that trust is based on physically meeting people. And now with blockchain, we have the enabler of global leverage of these values. And that is why at a certain point I dedicated my, let's say, rest of my professional life to blockchain applications. I truly believe in that as a societal game changer. And I was the one 10 years ago who basically put it on the map of the European Commission when we did this brainstorming on future innovation priority. And I proposed blockchain because I think that blockchain is indeed this key enabler.
And that was 2015, right? So pretty early.
And I'm very happy to say that at least on paper, at least from what we've been doing, and we've been doing a lot since also in the big economy, we see blockchain as important as, for example, artificial intelligence or supercomputing, quantum computing. We don't talk too much of it, but in the background, we do a lot of work.
And that's really great to hear, because often, you know, people talk so much about AI, about quantum computing, and I often have the feeling, oh, are people now forgetting blockchains and crypto? So it's good to hear that they are not, right? So it's really reassuring to hear.
It is in a way, but it's also difficult, Jonas, because we have made the experience, if you want to reach the decision makers, the moment you start talking about blockchain, they turn deaf. So in a way, we had to learn the hard way that we need to talk about the utility these brings in a sort of neutral way. We will talk later about privacy, but also, of course, on authentication of document, preventing the import of fake products, securing documents in the digital space, digital identity, data protection, all these things that are extremely important, but you need to take it from a functional perspective. And then afterwards say, by the way, this is what blockchain does. And it doesn't work the other way around. So you indeed, for good reasons, read very little about what we do on blockchain, but we have a lot of initiatives that I can tell you will only work on DLT-based systems.
Mm-hmm. And this means this is due to the negative connotation, you know, from blockchain that came from Bitcoin, like where media's report, you know, and FTX, or where is this coming from that, you know, it's rejected if the term blockchain is there, that it's like, oh, I put my hands away.
It comes from two directions. I mean, first, indeed, that the large majority of people you talk to still see blockchain as crypto as Bitcoin. And while Bitcoin has a sort of, I would say, at least mixed connotation, which is already progress, of course, FTX, before that Terra Luna, some other things have had a certain effect, because most decision makers read mainstream media. I do not, but that's where a lot of the information comes from, and this is very limited. So in a way, it is, I would say, innocent lack of knowledge, to put it mildly. But there are also very strong groups out there that use these sort of, let's say, criminal aspects that you find in, for example, digital finance, although in my opinion, much less than in traditional ways of finance when you look at money laundering with cash and tons of other ways like that on purpose, because they see the danger that these technologies, these decentralized technologies, bring to the legacy system, and they fight that with every mean. And this is where we have now certain tendencies, where you see from a number of regulators, where you also see from, let's say, certain things, reports that organizations like Interpol or Europol have been taken out, where privacy-enhancing technologies, zero-knowledge proofs, for instance, are marked in a sort of dubious way, as if this would primarily help criminals. Whereas I am very strongly of the opinion that privacy is a fundamental human right. Privacy is the enabler of digital progress. And therefore, for me, it's exactly the other way around. And there, I must say, we have at this moment a quite deep-going conflict between the two sides, where a negative picture is very often being drawn for anything that relates to blockchain and crypto, not because people don't understand it, but because people want to create, let's say, a fake image in order to continue to do what they've always done. But good news is they will not succeed.
And that's exactly the kind of positive attitude we need, and we also push in this podcast. And I mean, what I'm hearing, Joachim, is like two things. A is, of course, that all the worlds are putting into the same buckets, like blockchain, Bitcoin, and also in wrong buckets, because it's often not compared also with the fiat world. So which is an issue, a challenge. And I mean, I hear already our listeners, our Bitcoiners, that you're just like saying, yeah, of course, Bitcoin is different. You know, there is no second best. So I hear that in my...
Bitcoin is more narrow. I haven't said this.
I think that's something, of course, also with the podcast, you know, we work on to improve education, like for years, you know, you do this for decades. But the other thing is for me now a little bit like more concerning when I hear what you say, because that's more about a... you know, ideologies about preserving their own role, about, you know, that it's basically something decentralized that you want to fight, because we live in a society and there are a lot of jobs and entities created based out of centralization, right? So, and I think that's really hard to fight, isn't it?
It is, but I must say there's probably too much sunshine in my heart. But I would really say, Jonas, you can also read that from the other side. I mean, the fact that we have this situation means that we are being taken very seriously. And that is where, let's say, the period of ignorance and the period of simple disregard of what is happening in the crypto space is over. And now people realize globally how important this trend is, this long-term trend that has been emerging. We have, as everyone knows, the biggest institutional player now coming into the field, which doesn't make me happy, but which is, of course, a good sign of that there is now a serious interest involved. And that is a good sign that only less than 17 years after the Bitcoin white paper, we have a technology that has come so far. We've hardly ever had that in human history, I must say. So in that sense, I would see it as positive. The second thing is we fall short of analyzing the situation only from an economic or legal or even IT perspective. This is an anthropological dimension that we need to consider. So basically, we have an old generation in power that has been formed mentally by a world where all of this has not existed, and they struggle with that. And the new generation, 4 billion gamers globally, a young generation that organically grows up with these things, is now coming through the institutions year after year. We see that already in part with the new European Parliament, and they take over. And so the question is not if we win, the question is when we win. And that is a matter of still a couple of more days, years, of course, to come, maybe 10, 15, pin me down on a specific number of years. But this is the demographic effect that we've always seen in history. We had that after the fall of the Iron Curtain in 1989, when people didn't suddenly start believing in market economics, but continued their old belief system. But then a young generation come in. Now we realize, of course, that all these Anglo-American cheap utilitarianism and profit maximization, I say that as an economist, is as wrong as we always thought from day one, because people are community-driven and people are also social value-driven. And that is exactly what the technology conveys. So in that sense, all the bits and pieces fall together in a very nice picture, but the transition to what we can achieve on the basis of technology is more time-consuming, is more difficult than we might have thought, but that is the luxury of being a historian, that I think long term. So for me, 17 years is basically nothing. I know that investors and young people think differently because they are impatient, but I'm fully convinced that we go where we want to.
And I mean, that's always so important to zoom out. And that's also what we try with this podcast so often, you know, if it's really about, I mean, of course, in this ETF, as you mentioned, right, there are positive and negative things around that, right? But if you just look at the amount of volume that went into these products, it's unprecedented, you know.
It is, and crypto needs volume. I mean, when the commission started working on MiCA, just as an example, I'm not discussing commission policies here, but the nucleus was the ICO hype in 2017 to then proactively find something that is supportive. The stablecoin part came only 2 years later. And in that sense, I would say these positive things are out there. We try to find a way to help that build. And that came at a time when the market was still extremely small. I mean, I'm not aware of any piece of financial regulation anywhere where the market has been so small as for crypto, even when MiCA came into force. And now to have the crypto market increase, specifically now through stablecoins, is a positive thing. I see it indeed with a mixed feeling, because I'm a very radical anarchist in the way of decentralization. So I would love to have Bitcoin and Monero and Zcash and whatever is around there purely in the hand of activists that are detached from the world. But I know, of course, that this is an illusion, and that in order to build the world that we want to, we have to get everything into our boats, the big ones, the old ones, the lasting ones, the others, which is a good thing to happen. But my concern at the moment is to preserve the core of the radical thinking and evolution that is possible with the technology. And this is why I'm now focusing so much on the privacy-enhancing technologies, because these are under fire. And I think that if there is not a part that is autonomous from centralized decision-making, that cannot be prohibited, that is just there if you want it or not, like DAOs also, for example, you don't see them, but they are there. If this is the case, then I think we have good chances to move in the right direction. But if we lose the core of radical path creators and trendsetters, then we have a societal problem.
So what I take from this, Joachim, is basically A, preserve the key values and try to work on initiatives preserving this key values, firstly, and secondly, be patient, generally.
That is what I would say. I mean, I'm now in the business like you, Jonas, for so many years, and I sometimes have these meetings that undoubtedly you also have in your work, where the traditional Bitcoin people come and talk about something, then come the, say, Bitcoin forks, then come other people also in the decentralized space. Someone explains to me that my interpretation of ZK proofs is somewhat erroneous because there's other stuff, etc. If you continue splitting hairs, I mean, I know that if you dedicate your professional life to building a specific part of the technology, it's extremely important for you to understand every detail. But from a societal perspective, we need to cooperate. We need to create momentum. We need to be assertive to really build a strong power as a group of people that believe in this technology in general, and let not ourselves be split too much. I spent quite some time recently at some conferences where we had representatives of the cyberpunk movement, for example. Cyberpunk movement has been extremely important for me in this work. And sometimes nowadays, when I listen to neo-cyberpunks, I have the feeling that I'm attending a meeting of the Banking Federation or something like that. So I, of course, understand the importance of compliance, and I understand the relevance of finding your place in business. But there must also be hardcore cyberpunks that just push forward the technology. And this is, at the end of the day, what is happening anyway. I mean, look at the convergence of blockchain and AI. We will very soon have basically apps where every child can talk to a chatbot, and the AI in the background is programming a smart contract on what they discuss the moment that they speak. And what does that mean in terms of innovation, of responsibility also of the developer that we come to later with the Digital Freedom Declaration? Does that then mean that liability is extended to anyone who is coding, who is creating a platform, perhaps the parents of the child, because the child, if it has a certain age, is not liable in any way? So who is liable? This is the wrong direction that we move to. We live in a world where very, very soon We do not know whom we encounter in Web3. Is it a human? Is it a machine? What is the value system, etc.? And we have to find a way to deal with these things. And if we continue only progressing so slowly from our legacy system perspective on extrapolating a little bit of our old rules in this regard here, we are completely outpaced and outperformed by technology. And this is what we have to realize, why it is so important indeed to preserve the understanding and also the control in a way of this trajectory that we are building.
Yeah. And I really liked what you said also, that this collaborative angle is so important. And that's also why, I mean, for me personally, kind of my personal mission is also to really create a lot of ecosystems, communities, you know, these platforms where you can exchange, where you can, you know, work together in the sense, because often I have the feeling that, and I mean, you're way closer to this politics angle, right? But often stuff is happening in a way that, or where the people basically, you know, are crying like the loudest, right? And that's often something where, you know, I also think it needs, you know, some kind of counter positions just naturally, so that you are in the end aligned somewhere in the middle of the spectrum and not at the way, you know, at the very right where some people, I mean, not right in a political way, right, but at a place where just the people shouting out loudest get exactly what they want, right? Because that's not necessarily the best. Often it is just not the best.
And that's a bit the situation. I mean, you have to realize that I'm reporting that in neutral terms, because it is what it is, that very often, and that includes myself actually as an individual, people only react when really something bad happens. So you have a crisis suddenly, like the financial crisis, you need to save a bank over a weekend before business starts Monday morning, whereas in the past we had 2 or 3 years for a state aid procedure. That is the moment where things kick in. It's the same with problems that we see now. I was in the committee for fighting terrorist financing and anti-money laundering, basically, when we had these attacks in Paris and Brussels. And when then we have a European Council meeting here, the first thing they say is strengthen the rules. So we look at each other, we say, what should else we strengthen? The problem is not that there are no rules. Problem is that people don't cooperate in the different agencies and stuff like that. But rules have to be strengthened. That's the logic, is that for a long time, nothing happens. And then when something goes wrong, suddenly things have to happen very quickly, which is in a way why people need to be prepared. And that is also something that I try to explain for all the work, the network building that you say, the various platforms, etc. I also work like that, and I have a high respect for what you are doing and the Digital Euro Association there. We need to be proactive in order to be ready when, let's say, the moment comes. And the moment will come, but the window, the opportunity, is a very short period. And then you have to get your stuff together, which is why building structures is so important, which is why getting ready is so important.
Mm. And getting ready, maybe the perfect transition to the Digital Freedom Declaration, Joachim. So initiative that you launched, I said, I'm also supporting this because I think it's super, super important. It you know, hits a lot of core values that I personally present, and something that I think has been missing in the space, was just not around. And maybe Joachim, you can tell us a little bit more, like what this initiative is. How did you come up with establishing this initiative, etc.?
First of all, I must say, Jonas, I'm very grateful to you personally, but also to the Digital Euro Association as a whole for being day one supporters of this initiative. So thank you very much for this. There is a short-term reason and there is a longer perspective on this. The short-term reason is that I have been following from the beginning the Tornado Cash case in the Netherlands, where we have this crypto mixer, where the developers have been arrested in the Netherlands, one, and then two in the US, or one in the US, and the second is now at large. And although there has been no legal requirement whatsoever, crypto mixers are not prohibited in the European Union. It's not in MiCA, it's not in transfer of funds. At that time that Tornado Cash came about, they were perfectly allowed to do what they do. Even more, they are creating privacy in an area where I think it is desperately needed. And a lot of good actors, governments, but also very serious industrial companies, by the way, are using crypto mixers for a number of reasons that we might speak about later if you want. So it's a legitimate business. But as the Netherlands have a very strict interpretation of the anti-money laundering rules, they have arrested Alexei Purtsev. And he has been sentenced to 5 years and 4 months in prison, basically because they think that Tornado Cash is a criminal organization. It is for them a centralized organization consisting of three people, disregarding the DAO structure and the way that their governance systems and the tokens work, etc. Completely disregarding also the open source aspects that you put a smart contract out there. I mean, the funny thing is, of course, and it's not funny for them, that Tornado Cash has been fully operational the whole time, that actually you could trade the token, and where, according to the prosecutor and then also the court, these people have been in prison and should have controlled all of that, but it shows the open source nature. And what really makes me angry is that in my responsibility for the real economy, I do not see any other part of our society where this type of liability is used. If you take any physical item, take a car or take a gun, but let's talk about a car that is physically produced. We know that bank robbers use cars. And sorry, I have to use this example very often, but there might be one listener that hasn't heard it yet. So we have all the technical means to monitor with all the cameras in a car, who's in there, where the car is going. We can remotely shut down the engine. The technology exists. We can have sort of GPS or Galileo-based systems where if the car comes too close to a bank, you could shut it down or whatever. They're all technical means that we can use to prevent that a criminal act happens with a car, at least certain types of criminal acts. No one ever came to their mind that you arrest the CEO of BMW or Audi, because it's usually fast German cars that are used for bank robberies in that regard. But apparently in the digital domain, when you write code and the code goes out there and you don't do anything, but sometime later someone uses your code for a criminal purpose, then you are not only liable, but you will be imprisoned. And this is what happens. And if you look at the interpretation also of the money flows through the mixer, throughout the period that this case was going on, the percentage and the volume was increasing and increasing, basically on some, what I would say, flawed conceptualization from certain companies in the security business, that as we cannot see if anything is legitimate money, now we have more technologies to do that, but not at the time when Tornado Cash came about, they say that basically 100% of that is probably illegal, and then every crypto hack that happened was associated with Tornado Cash because criminals used it to launder their money. Whereas the only thing that they are doing is just creating these pots where you insert a little bit of ETH and then you have the right to extract again at a certain later moment the same amount of ETH. That's all that there is. It's a very, very simple thing just used for privacy. And this makes me extremely angry. And then we realized that this goes far beyond the case. So Jonas, relating to what we've just discussed, if I were now to make a fuss about this situation and I would get all the crypto people on board, which actually I have, at least in private. Some of them don't want to support this publicly because they're concerned about what people might think about them, etc. But most people that I know would actively support that. But for the societal perspective, crypto people are not really taken seriously. So we need to much more broaden the discussion, because the responsibility and the actually positive effect that developers and coders have for digital technologies, for privacy-enhancing technologies, does not only relate to crypto blockchain. It relates to AI. It relates to every aspect that we have in society, which is why we need to have a fundamental and very broad discussion about what the application of law in these contexts really mean in the digital economy, because that will be the standard case in Web3. And this is the discussion that we want to move forward. We want to have clear rules. We want to have education. We want to have consistency between the real world legal framework and the financial legal framework, because the financial legal framework is completely infested by this holy exaltation of anti-money laundering rules in the interpretation of some people that completely disregards any other aspects of innovation that might exist. And this is the purpose of the Digital Freedom Declaration. So a certain group, and let's say the declaration is there. The declaration does not have authors. So let's assume that the authors were a mix of Satoshi Nakamoto, an extraterrestrial, and Elvis Presley. That is what I tend to say in public. Someone must have written this declaration. And I humbly took the position to sign it because it meets my belief system.
And it's just out and there. It's decentralized.
It's just out there. It's just out there. Like the Bitcoin white paper just exists. It's on a dedicated web page, digitalfreedomininoneword.page.
That's all there is. We link this in the show notes. Yeah.
Indeed. And today we got another two signatories. I'm very happy to report. So we really, for the moment, have limited that to very serious organizations and individuals because we want to avoid that we are flooded by a few hundreds of thousands of crypto bots or whatever that want to sign this declaration and then everyone says, oh, that's the nonsense that there is. So at the moment, we have 12 important organizations and businesses as well as 22 experts that have signed this declaration. We hope for many more. And can encourage people please to take a look. And if you want, support it. There's a button at the bottom where you can click a contact point. And then if you want to support it, those unknown people that have drafted this will
exactly. So at some desk or in some email inbox.
Some desk somewhere out there, they might look at this and onboard.
Who knows there? Yeah. So thanks for providing this overview, Joachim. And I think there are so many analogies. I mean, you took this car example, which I really liked. I mean, often you also get the example of a knife, right? So there are a lot of knives out there. And I mean, I would say net, a knife is a positive invention because you can cut food, meat, but you could also kill people, right?
The thing why I don't take the knife example is that we have this situation that is so much politically heated. I mean, we had this situation a couple of months ago when in certain areas, for very good reasons, there was the idea to prevent people from coming with a knife. And then you had the grandmother with a Swiss pocket knife basically being presented with a fine from the police because she carried that little knife. I personally think that a Swiss pocket knife is part of a human body, as is two hands and two feet. But this is a very loaded discussion. So I want to avoid this thing about arms as such or weapons. Yeah. You can even point it down to very simple daily things like cars, but also other things where just you do not have this approach that is being taken on code that is written for financial purposes.
Yeah. And I mean, I also just, you know, share from my perspective why I also decided to support this, because generally I have the feeling that there are a lot of topics in this whole space that have basically come up or have been accelerated coming from Bitcoin, from blockchain technology. And one is definitely the topic of privacy. And I mean, we discussed in this podcast, Joachim, I can share a few episodes with you after this one as well, on zero knowledge proof. So I think we had 3, 4, 5 episodes on zero knowledge proofs over the past few years, advocating for people looking into this also for years. And I mean, the thing is now that even you have seen the updates, the announcement that this technology, for example, now is even used by Google, by some big techs into their stacks when it comes to dating apps. So basically, for example, you know, proving that, yes, I'm older than 18 without revealing anything more, like a standard CK use case, which I think is generally good to see because it's like more going into this mainstream adoption. But on the other hand side, if people from the crypto space build something with CK, put this out there open source, right, then they get imprisoned, like the Tornado Cash case that you mentioned.
But that's a little bit the issue. I mean, I can tell you my colleagues at the European Commission and the projects we are involved in, we have on the basis of this European blockchain services infrastructure, EBSI, for those that are familiar with it, more than 25 big use cases, really big use cases in very different sectors. The lead one is this anti-counterfeiting open source blockchain infrastructure where we use a sort of digital product passport to detect fake products. And we always use technologies like zero knowledge proofs. I mean, we have a concept that we call proof of authority when you have a public document out there to onboard you, but then the transactions need to be kept secret. And you use technologies like these to do that. So it's not only that we are talking, that is please something very important to me. I'm not holding a lecture here, but everything that I say is being implemented right now in the things that we do. And I think if we do that, that's a very strong sign of the value of things where others can do it as well. And I therefore am disturbed by people that are not coming from the European Commission or not coming from the European institutions, to be very clear, but from others outside that indeed, as you say, judge behavior not by the nature of behavior, but by the person who is doing it. And this is discrimination. It is even much worse than discrimination because this is totalitarianism. You do not judge anyone by a legal standard. Just say, I don't like you. And that is also something, of course, that plays a role here. I mean, look at the nationality of the people that worked on Tornado Cash. I remain unconvinced that this does not play any role in this discussion here. But if you go out in the mainstream news outlets and say that authorities have shut down a money laundering service built by Russians that has been used by the North Koreans, etc., you have people getting a heart attack in senior homes out there, where I see the 80-year-old with a chamomile tea basically calling a doctor because this is the worst thing that people can imagine. If you look at the reality, it is so far away from this. And this is what this framing is. This is fake news. This is a sort of approach that is very, very dangerous in terms of the liberal standards for freedom and civil law that we have in Europe, but also in the world. And this is why this struggle is so important. This is not about Tornado Cash. This is not about crypto. This is not about anything limited. This is about how you, I, our children, everyone out there want to live in the future in a society. Do we want to use technology to be controlled by everyone? Or do we see what we always say in our Sunday speeches, that digital innovation is so important, we need to be competitive, we need to create enterprises, we need to attract intelligent people with all the skills to build our future economy. And hey, when you start building that, people look at you and say that, oh, that's a nasty thing, you get into prison. I mean, this is not the society, Jonas, that we want to live in.
And this really creates some kind of, you know, wrong values and precedents that, that just overdo a lot of things. Because, of course, you know, the one thing is, from a personal perspective, it's a shame that people getting imprisoned for something which you also said there is not really, you know, a strong legal case for that. I mean, you can interpret this in different things and consider nationalities, and then it's becoming political, but not based on law, maybe on, you know, some precedent cases. But of course, you know, it's also, and this is going more into a, let's say, business perspective, of course, this also impedes a lot of innovation, right? Because
it does so. And that is the big thing, really, that I know from a lot of discussions, and you will undoubtedly too, that a number of people are now shying away from being as innovative as they can be. They either hide somewhere outside Europe to continue doing what they do, or they feel restrained because they don't know what happens. And this is very, very negative for our economy and our society. I must say at the same time, and this is really also a call for everyone, that there is an obligation for both sides. I mean, if I see what has been discussed in this case, and I know the case very well, I am amazed how intelligent people, and I don't say that the prosecutor or the court are in any way stupid or prejudiced or so. Absolutely no. I think these are normal people that just try to understand something that is completely new to them. But how they can so strongly misinterpret what a DAO does in terms of governance, in terms of their tokens, in terms of how they vote, how they take decisions, but also how they create a smart contract that they put then out in the system that continues to exist, and how we can see that really only through the narrow lens of traditional criminal behavior, where every activity that you take, which might increase the value of your token, which is completely normal stuff to do, is seen as a criminal act in itself, because that increases your reward from your criminal activity. And reasoning like that, I mean, one could get the shivers if one reads that. My interpretation of a token is basically that people get tokens because they don't have serious money, and you hope that the value of whatever you do increases, and the value increases, the value of a token increases, and at a certain moment you can have some gain out of that. That is how business works. That is how startups work. That is completely normal behavior. But in this context, it is seen as the mother of all evil. And this is where I must say the narrative of the developers, the narrative of the digital innovators is so far not good enough, because they have not yet managed to find a convincing storyline for those people outside their bubble to reasonably understand what they do. And this is where I actually lay, and this is also the purpose of the Digital Freedom Declaration. We are not blaming only the legacy system. We are basically saying that everyone has to get their act together, because this is a dialogue from two sides. And therefore, we call for clear rules. We call for incentives. We call for punishment and sanctions for those that abuse the smart contracts and the code, because it's their liability, not the creator's liability. But at the end of the day, you have to be to the best of your knowledge. I mean, only to end on this reflection, I see the Tornado Cash people really, there are people that started with something and then it's somewhat spinned out of control. Now we are 2025. We are 6 years later, and we have possibilities to be more selective when, for example, we create privacy-enhancing technologies to go into systems where we can have assurances that money is actually legitimate money and not criminal money. So while I am 100% for the full anonymity, and while I'm 100% of the opinion that ideally, and I know it's radical, everything should be outside the control of centralized agencies, there is also a responsibility of people that are in these systems to distinguish themselves from the rest that has a lower purpose in their ambition. And only if you can do that, if you can get your ethics straight also through inbuilt incentives, then you have a chance of succeeding. And that is what I believe. You might call me naive, but I truly believe, and I know that most people I talk to in the crypto space, they are social people, but they're not, certainly not criminals. And this is where we need to get our act together much better than in the past, to get a dialogue with the legacy system and convince them of what we do.
So this means, and I think that's very important that you added, that it's not about saying, you know, there shouldn't be punishments for, you know, illegal deeds that people did or something like that. It's really just a question where the liability lies, and it shouldn't be with the creator that just puts something out there, but with the people that take the stuff that is out there, so in the sense the code, and use it then for provably illegal purposes. Did I get this correct?
You get this completely correct, Jonas. And that is also something that guides me now in my work, for example, on DAOs. I mean, we did with a very good team a DAO study last year. And one key focus to which I'm looking also now in the upcoming European Blockchain Regulatory Sandbox with the very, very good team of Bird and Bird and the companies that are involved there is indeed these aspects of liability. I personally, but that is only my personal opinion, believe that a DAO should of course be liable, but that is the right of the DAO to choose how they deal with that. So I do not wish to extend the traditional system of KYC, which is completely unrealistic for these chat room types of digital things. I mean, you can, you know, that go into every sort of digital chat room without knowing who's there, and you just start
and also AI
stuff.
Bots coming up,
AI,
right?
AI bots, etc. That is the future. So you have no control on that. But the moment that you engage as a competitor in a regulated activity where you also have to face contractual law questions, liability, etc., the DAO has to find a solution for that. And my approach is to say that we have to find a way, and we make some proposals, that the DAO decides on its own who bears the liability. All the votes are on chain. I mean, at the end of the day, the DAO can find a rule-based system for governance where they say, for example, whoever voted in favor of something, which later turned out to be problematic, carries the liability. Or we all do, or we find a way where no one does, but we create a fund somewhere that can pay the fines if we face fights. The liability and the contractual obligations are there, and they have to be met. But we must also meet the reality of future digital life, where we have unknown communities doing stuff, actually very important and good stuff, and where we need to find a reconciliation between this massively important and innovative development that is going on there with the very traditional rules in the legacy system that have never been written for digital systems. That is the challenge that we actually face.
And maybe to kind of summarize this at the end, so what I think we now really well understood where, you know, this Digital Freedom Declaration is coming from, that some magic Satoshi kind of person put this out.
Don't forget Elvis. Yes, he was also involved.
And Elvis, sorry, forgot him already. And that it is in the money in the declaration, basically, that it needs more education. So that also what you said, that people are not taking decisions with just a specific lack of knowledge. It's about incentives. It's about getting the liability straight. Well, what else would you add when it comes to what the concrete call to actions is? Or put differently, if people would say, oh, I want to support this, what are you actually supporting?
I would like to take a very humble approach because I'm just the guy that sticks out his nose together with much more knowledgeable people like Judith de Boer from the Tornado Cash defense team and a number of others that are listed in the declaration. And I'm just the Tagesschau guy basically presenting now here the message. But all of this can be massively improved. I'm very sure that we have a lot of listeners out there who find quite a few perhaps technical mistakes or misunderstandings that I have in what I am presenting here. So this is a team effort. And I'm not saying this is the perfect declaration. I'm not saying that everything is really right as we say it. I want to open a discussion. And we need a discussion on this. And the last thing that I want to do is to extrapolate my personal value system to anyone else. I ask for respect for my opinions, but I have the fullest respect for other opinions. So if we come to a societal agreement in a way, where all of this has been discussed and is on the table, and people want a certain set of rules to have a better, let's say, control of things that are happening in Web3, etc., so be it. Most people want clarity of rules in order not to be criminalized, but you never get the perfect mix of rules. So that's where I would invite people to make us aware of things that can be improved. But also, please, and that's a plea to everyone, regardless of what you're doing, to try out and test certain things. If you've never seen a mixer, if you've never used a privacy coin, if you don't know what a smart contract is, try it out. I must say, I do that from time to time. I usually do that late in the evening, accompanied by very nice German beer, because after 2 minutes, I realize how utterly stupid I am when I try to program even the smallest thing or try to unpack a certain software package on my computer where I get error messages all over. But it's worthwhile to get a feeling for these things, because we should not be afraid. We should not believe those that pretend they have the knowledge, but basically just want, I'm sorry, to bullshit us. But we have to get a feeling of what the digital reality in the future looks like. And then you have the legitimacy to bring in your voice and to develop that in a direction that you want. So it's an open call for discussion. It is not more. It is not that we prejudge a discussion or want to have a specific outcome. But this core of the origin for the Digital Freedom Declaration, this punishing of innovative creators, is a scandal. And we have to overcome this scandal.
What really reminds me also in a lot of situations over the past few years is really this trying out aspects that you just mentioned. You know, I remember when I was in Washington at a conference like 3 or 4 years ago, and I showed these some of these folks, and they were all almost central bankers or, you know, from supranational institutions, economists like myself, and talking experts in cross-border payments, right? But just in like more theoretical academic type of research, as most people, I guess, in these institutions. And I showed them, you know, we were drinking some stuff. I don't remember what it was. And we were thinking, okay, how do we now split this stuff up, right? So people from the US, Latin America, Europe, and it was like, it's a pain. I mean, cash is one option, but you know, you don't have always cash with you, also not like in areas like Washington. And what I did is I showed them, you know, how easy it is to set up a Bitcoin Lightning wallet and how you can easily basically send funds across the globe within seconds, milliseconds, with final settlement in this sense. I mean, you can debate this, how you define settlement, but still for cheap costs. And they were all like overwhelmed. And even for one person, I remember that since then, the person is, you know, it went into the Bitcoin rabbit hole and is now pretty supportive on Bitcoin, where before he was not, because he didn't see this, right? And I'm just saying that this trying out is so important. And I have so often, and I'm sure you do have this as well, Joachim, in my discussions, the perspective. Also, people talk about stable coins, about DeFi, about, you know, some decentralized loans. They never tried it out. They never, you know, set up a MetaMask wallet to just connect to Uniswap. And again, you don't need to do this on a daily basis. I don't, to be honest. But you see what's possible, what's feasible, right?
And that's an extremely important point. I mean, Jonas, I have the luxury, and I'm really grateful to everyone, that I have a very large and strong network that basically, if I don't understand anything in my function, I just call people and they take half an hour or an hour to run me through. And this can be the most simple things. And this is actually why the sandboxes are so great, because that also allows policymakers and regulators to ask the most stupid question. But that is also something where the work that you are doing with it, Digital Euro Association, is so important. And as you've just mentioned stablecoins, I would like to remind people that the moment that we record this little discussion here, the Digital Euro Association has brought out a new report today on the role of stablecoins in financial sovereignty that I can only recommend, because while it is only out today, I can be pretty fast if I have to, otherwise I'm lazy. And I've read it through, and I must say, please read it, because this is a very clear set of arguments of why stablecoins are indeed important also for our societies in Central Europe, where a lot of people still think that this is something fishy from the rest of the world. So this type of work of developing the conceptual understanding, but also then doing it yourself, is so important. And the Lightning wallet that you've just mentioned also brings back the point, which I will not comment further today, for some people that still say Bitcoin is not for payments.
And so many people do still in 2025 say and write that?
Yes, they do, but it can be used. And I think that's the functionality that we are observing. I mean, things are getting more multifaceted. There is no traditional distinction anymore, because between purely payment and purely financial instrument for value preserving and creation purposes, etc. But we are getting more and more complex mixtures. And that is also something that you can only realize when you start experimenting that with your own. And this is the massive thing. I mean, last remark in this regard from me. I am very, very annoyed by, from time to time, reading in certain old-fashioned magazines about the laziness of the young generation. The young generation, in a playful way, is experimenting. I see it everywhere, with so many different digital technologies that will be important for the future, which will be a massive asset if we encourage that. And that is also what the Digital Freedom Declaration, but also your work, stands for, that we have to encourage. It's clear, of course, that when little children start staring into the smartphones too early, that they get a mental problem by their brain not functioning. Well, completely agreed to that. But a good knowledge of digital technologies in a playful way, in an educative way, is so extremely important. And that is why this movement is now building forces. So, and now comes the branding part, Digital Freedom Declaration, work of the Digital Euro Association, people out there, you are not investing in a lost cause. You're investing in the future of your children, your grandchildren, society as such. Get the job done, because we old people, I'm 57 now, we do not allow certain people to bring us into the corner that we ruin this planet. I don't accept this role. We are in a role where basically we are creating the tools that we make a massively amazing and funny and productive place out of this. And this is why you should join us, because we are the good ones.
And that's a really, really nice closing, Joachim. So I have really nothing to add to that, besides that we always doing exactly what you said in our disclaimer in the end and in the outro, and say, guys, you know, I mean, we are not, you know, this podcast also here is not, you know, for monetary purposes for us. It's fun. It's our lot of time from us that is going into that. And if you support us on this journey, and also, as you said, you know, support the world in which your children might live at some point, then of course, you know, share also, I mean, to the audience, all kind of podcast episodes of us, to, you know, share this with your families, etc. Because that's exactly also the way we are, where we want to go with this podcast, to just raise awareness, because everything you said, Joachim, like around education, around practical aspects, that's what we address here as well. So that all these concepts don't stay very theoretical, but more practical, so that really, you know, we can bring the society forward by really focusing on these aspects and not theoretical things that have been right 10 years ago, but are just completely outdated. So in the sense, Joachim, this was the first time having you in the podcast. Again, I cannot believe it took us 300 episodes. I will promise you, we will bring you in again and not wait with more 300 episodes, because so many things you mentioned today, I would like to discuss, or be it like, you know, your perspective of stablecoins, Bitcoin, CBDC. We had this on the preparation on, yes, some questions. We do this another time. Yeah. And take the time. And thanks for being with us, Joachim.
Thank you so much, Jonas. It was a great pleasure, as always, to talk with you. Thank you very much to everyone out there. I hope you did something useful while listening to us for the last 56 minutes, probably exercising or cooking or growing cactuses or whatever you do. So thanks also for your interest and hope to talk again soon.
Nice. And maybe the last question to you, Achim, is where can people learn more about you and your work? So we link the declaration, obviously, in the show notes. I think you're not on LinkedIn, if I'm not mistaken, right? So what should people do? Just send you an email like you know, people do? Or
yeah, I have the luxury of not being on any social media because most social media are still big tech infested, like LinkedIn. But those people that want to find me do find me. And in that regard, either ask Jonas or send me an email. I think that is available there. But best thing is use this magic button that you find below in the Digital Freedom Declaration. And the fantastic team that I alluded to behind that will find the way to put it into my private mailbox, which is where it belongs. So I am reachable. Contact anyone who knows me. And I am a very open person. I will be very happy to discuss with you if you have any insights, or also if you tell me how wrong all of this is. Please don't hesitate, because I learn most from my mistakes. Thanks very much.
Perfect. Thanks so much, Joachim. So if you want to be connected, please let me know. And then I'm happy to establish the connection. Or as you said, press the important button.
Press
the button. Right. So again, Joachim, thanks so much. Also, dear listeners, thanks for joining us again, whatever you did, growing cactuses, cooking, running, I don't know. Thanks for being with us. I can save now the disclaimer I'm always doing, but yeah, maybe just with one sentence. Subscribe to our channels, become part of our community. If you like this, refer us to your friends. That's some support you can give us so that we can bring the space forward and can drive more education in the space. In this sense, hear you to our next episode. Thanks so much for joining.
Thank you, bye-bye.
The views expressed are solely the personal opinions of the hosts and are provided for informational purposes only. This podcast does not offer financial or investment advice. Always conduct your own research and make well-informed decisions before investing. Please be aware that the hosts and guests may hold cryptocurrencies or digital assets discussed in this episode.